From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, remember this bit by comedian George Carlin?
I wanted to know the ones that you could never say on television. Cursing, cussing, swearing, and all I could think of was shit.
So why are Samantha Bee and others actually using some of those words on TV? Then Simon Baker makes the transition from acting to directing with his new film Breath, based on the Australian novel of the same name. And we visit an amazing place to hear music under the stars, the Mount Wilson Observatory. All that coming right up.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's Grownish, produced by ABC Signature Studios, Emmy-eligible for Outstanding Comedy Series, lead actress Yara Shahidi, and contemporary costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. A few months back, the Emmys organization announced its annual Television Academy honors, including programs that have leveraged the dynamic power of television to inspire social change. The honorees include Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, and the ceremony was last night, coinciding with a firestorm over Bee's vulgar comment about Ivanka Trump on Full Frontal. Reporters were disinvited from the ceremony, but IndieWire got a copy of Bee's acceptance speech. It read in part, quote, "Sometimes I should probably have a filter. I accept that," unquote. For more about filters, we talked with entertainment journalist Whitney Friedlander, and I began by asking her what the restrictions are on what can and can't be said on broadcast television.
There's the Safe Harbor Law, which has been on the books since 1934, which says, you know, they can't say anything scandalous or have defamatory language or anything that might be upsetting between the hours of 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. because that was theoretically when children would be the most likely to be watching. Now, of course, in 1934, kids didn't have smartphones. So we can have a debate about whether Safe Harbor needs to be updated or anything like that. But as far as Sam B goes, this is a cable channel. It was also aired, of course, after the hours. And each channel has its own standards and practices that they have to abide by. For whatever reason, with the Sam Bee situation, those words made it to air.
The FCC famously has seven words that you cannot say on television. One of them, I think we can now say, it's piss. The other six, not so much. And they were made famous by the comedian George Carlin in a 1972 monologue called Seven Words You Can Never Say on Television. Let's listen to George Carlin right now.
I wanted to know the ones that you could never say on television. Cursing, cussing, swearing, and all I could think of was shit, piss,
are those words now not really as prohibited as they had been in the past?
It does depend on a situation-by-situation basis. So I wrote a story for Variety last year that quoted FX boss John Landgraf, who had said something at TCA a few years before, saying that, you know, he hoped to come to a time where we didn't have this situation in place. Last year, Feud, which was the new anthology at the time, new anthology show on FX that was co-created by Ryan Murphy, another FX favorite, used the exact same word that Sam Bee is now in trouble with. Now, of course, that was a scripted show. They knew about it way ahead of time. They were prepared for how it was going to go by.
What was the reaction when the C word was used on the FX series Feud?
Nothing like this. But again, because it wasn't specifically attacking someone who is a conservative member of the Trump family, it didn't have the same impact. What is specifically interesting about Sam Bee is that her show has always been a show where she is speaking as the rage demon that is living inside every liberal everywhere for the past few years since her show launched. And saying that term specifically at someone whom she's angry with as a woman, as a mother, and someone whom she feels has insulted or degraded or not lived up to the promises that she's supposed to be doing, it hit a nerve. And it does start a debate about whether, is this political commentary, is it allowed?
Well, and I think it's fair to say, too, that had Samantha Bee not said this a couple of days after Roseanne Barr lost her show,
correct,
for what she said, it would have been a different story. Now, like a lot of people, I find the C word morally repugnant. And there is a difference, though, between what is morally repugnant and what is not permissible. So when the standards and practices team is looking at Samantha Bee's show and it's taped, what is the kind of standard way in which that kind of show or any show is vetted? And was there, in your mind, maybe a failure to vet this and not anticipate the backlash?
In hindsight, TBS is saying, we probably shouldn't have done that. And they have issued an apology, and they have said since that Sam Bee, in issuing her own apology, which read a little bit like it was under duress if you look at it under Twitter, but she did issue an apology, have said, you know, we're good. That's all we're going to do to punish Sam Bee. They probably also didn't think it was going to cause this big a surprise. Because, again, as anyone who's ever watched Sam Bee's show knows, she has a reputation for saying specifically pointed things at anyone who she feels has wronged her or failed her. And this is particularly directed to members of Trump's family and other members of the Republican Party.
Ultimately, this comes down, I think, to a business decision. Some advertisers are leaving Full Frontal. Is that the way that these stories typically play out, that the network makes a calculation of whether or not losing advertisers is worth keeping the show, whether or not losing the show is worth, you know, the public relations benefit you might get? What is the calculation that the distributors and makers of Full Frontal would be going through right now?
At this point, they're probably hoping it's going to blow over because they feel like they probably have enough fan feedback on their side. They are probably watching carefully to see which advertisers pull away. They also have to look at the bigger picture. TBS is owned by Turner, which also owns CNN, which has criticized Sam Bee for this action. So they have to sit there and calculate, how much is this blowback worth? How long do they think it's going to take? Will we still have viewers after this? And honestly, it's possible Sam Bee's ratings might go up. I mean, with someone like Sam Bee, might be like, bring it on. She's the type of person who has enough, you know, as we discussed, anger and hostility and aggression and a fan base to do something like that, to say, let's see what happens. Like, you really think that's the worst I can do?
Whitney Friedlander is a freelance entertainment journalist. You could Google her article in Variety, FCC Censorship Rules Vary for Broadcast Cable and Streaming. Whitney, thanks so much for coming on the show.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Australian actor Simon Baker has made his career in American film and television. He's probably best known for his role as Patrick Jane in the CBS crime drama The Mentalist, which ran for 7 seasons. Now he's directed and co-written his first feature film. It's called Breath, and it's based on the 2008 novel of the same name by the celebrated Australian author Tim Winton. The book is a coming-of-age story that follows two teenage boys, Looney and Pikelet, as they grow up and discover surfing. Baker also co-stars in the film as a former professional surfer named Sando, who becomes a father figure for the two boys. Breath is set in Western Australia and explores how that wild landscape influences its inhabitants.
One of the biggest casting choices was the location of where to shoot it. And, you know, also thinking about the story in the process of development, for me, that rite of passage was so enmeshed with where I was in the world and my relationship with landscape. You know, it's consistent. It's all powerful. We just sort of pass through it. And this is a story about two boys that pass through it, that there's been thousands before and there'll be thousands afterwards. And the landscape sort of teaches a lot of the lessons as well as nurtures these guys through this story.
Why did you want to be a part of this movie? And did you enter it first as an actor and then as a director? What was your process to become part of the production?
Well, Mark Johnson, he called me up and said, I've just read this book and I think you'd be you'd be very interested in it, and I have a chance to option it. So he sent it to me, and it was my childhood in so many ways, and it opened me up. And I called him back straight away and said, "Yeah, I'm in." But that was really just to produce it with him, and to play Sander. And then as time went on, he realized how close this story was to me. And after a number of meetings with different directors, he said to me after a meeting, he said, "Look, has it occurred to you that maybe you should direct this thing?" And I said, "Why do you ask?" And he said, "Because you talk like the director."
More so than the people you're asking to be a director.
I don't know if that was an insult or not.
What was it about your own life that you saw in the story of these kids? Where did you relate to it most personally?
Oh, well, obviously the environment and the relationship to the ocean and surfing. But a major part of it was my relationship with a prescribed notion of what masculinity should be in that environment, and struggling with that silently, kind of, you know, at that time in Australia. And I wanted to explore the cracks and the fissures in the masculine sort of ideal, or what we assume to be ideal.
Your character in the film, Sando, is sort of a alternative father figure to the two boys. And he's also somebody who's not only passionate about surfing, but also passionate about sharing his love of surfing with these kids, mm-hmm. and showing them basically where to go. So I want to play a scene from the film about the boys seeing men surfing for the first time.
Never had I seen men do something so beautiful, so pointless and elegant. As if dancing on water was the best and bravest thing a man could do.
First of all, we should note that the novelist is your narrator, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Reluctantly.
Reluctantly? How did you persuade him?
He was reluctant at first, and then I think, you know, he saw the film and he felt a little more inclined to want to do it.
There are typical ways that a film director would look at athletic performance in a film. Typically, they cast actors who might be able to do the sport. Mm-hmm. And there's some exceptions. Gavin O'Connor in the film Miracle did something extraordinary where he cast hockey players who could act. And you chose to get surfers who could act. Was that always important to you, that the surfing be authentic, that it not be digital face replacement or some super long shot so you don't really see the characters in the water?
It was paramount importance. It had to be. You know, I like the intimacy of a story like this, and with this great landscape, oceanscape, to take those characters in an intimate way and put them in that environment, you had to stay close. You had to make the transition from land to water with them for that experience to feel authentic. So it was always, for me, that side of it had to be completely genuine and with no artifice, because any artifice will take you out of the story.
We're talking with Simon Baker. He's the director, producer, and co-writer of the new film, Breath. I should say you're also the co-star of the film. What is it like to direct yourself? You've done it in television. What were the things that you learned about doing it on television that you wanted to make sure you remembered when you're on set with this film?
Just to relax, you know, not to put too much pressure. You kind of, so often in television, you're kind of on your own, particularly if you've established a character that you know very well. But the other side of it is when you're doing it in a film, you get into the edit and you realize that it's a constant disappointment with yourself in so many ways, and you start to kind of enjoy that disappointment or just accept it.
One of the things that I think is clearly very important to you is the sound and feel and look of what it means to be underwater in the ocean.
We're gonna play a little game.
Okay.
We're gonna see who can touch the bottom first. Ready? One, two, three.
There is a different world that exists under the surface of the ocean, and it's a magical world. It's a little bit dangerous, but it's transformative. Like, you go 1 foot under the water and you're in a different environment. How did you go about capturing that?
Well, because we shot in all practical locations, you know, so we were all out there in the water, with the boats and underwater, there was an ease to it because there was a common language. All of the cast in the water and my cinematographer Rick Raffici all have a history from surfing, so we all know where everyone's going to go in any given moment. So there's an ease and a comfort in the water. So the simpler we shot it, the better. That way you can maintain that intimacy. It's very hard and a little bit hit and miss. So when you're cutting, a lot of the time it's almost like cutting found footage. So there's a slight sort of documentarian approach to the edit, because you don't do two takes the same.
Right. You can't have continuity. It's like, can we move the wave over this way and the bubble is going that way?
Yeah. So that's challenging. It was small crew, very nimble, and a lot of humility, really.
One of the things that was interesting about the making of this film is how much Western Australia and other government agencies were willing to invest in the film. Mm-hmm. That's such a foreign concept in the United States, that we have tax incentives and rebates and there's other things, but that the government believes in the arts and will fund the production of a film because they believe it's a story that has to be told and that represents a part of the world that they want people to understand. What is that process like, and how do you go about getting that funding and making sure that you can tell your own story and not be beholden to their interests?
Well, I think their main directive is to preserve cinematic culture of our country. And, you know, there's a lot of different stories to be told, and there's a lot of cultures within Australia, you know, so it's quite broad. They want to try to always promote Australian content. So this is Tim Winton. He's a revered Australian author, so that's a big tick. You have to apply on all these different levels as an Australian film, and they've got a foot in both camps. So they obviously want to promote potential commercial projects, a la Baz Luhrmann sort of stuff, but then they also want to preserve things that they think there's a validity culturally to keep, to mark that in the time capsule of a film, which that's exciting to me. We don't have a burgeoning industry like you have over here. It's a cottage industry and it needs to be nurtured. So it's basically been the heartbeat, the bloodline of our industry for a long time now.
When you make a movie like this that is personal to you in terms of what it says about adolescence and mm-hmm. maybe what it reminds you of your own adolescence, and you're kind of working on a smaller budget, you're a kind of small guerrilla crew telling a very independent story, does it change your priorities going forward about the kinds of stories that you want to tell? How does the experience affect you in terms of choices that you might make going ahead?
Well, if you look at where I came from, John, just recently 7 years on network television, it's a completely different animal. So yes, this voice in me has been in there for a while, sort of fighting to want to get out, but you got to put a roof over your head. So yes, it does inspire me to want to tell heartfelt stories, to delve a bit more and explore. But I think at the moment, cinema's now dividing into two different worlds, where we've got the big tentpole blockbuster entertainment value serialized to within an inch of its life. And then we have movies that sort of open up our psyche and let us have a look at who we are, and that are also socially conscious and help inform us as we go further forward. So there's a real shift between those two worlds, and I'm kind of okay with it. Just a couple of sort of thoughtful kind of comedies in between would be good too.
Simon Baker, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, John.
Breath opens today in New York, and it comes to Los Angeles on June 8th. And now, site-specific art and concerts are all the rage these days, and it can feel like a gimmick to hear, say, a chamber orchestra play in a warehouse or an abandoned hospital. But as the Frame contributor Tim Grieving reports, the summer concert series at the Mount Wilson Observatory is worth the trek up the Angeles Crest Highway.
It takes about 45 minutes to get from Pasadena to the Mount Wilson Observatory, but but the views going up the winding Angeles Crest Highway make the travel time worthwhile. I'm here on a cool Sunday afternoon, walking from the dirt parking lot up a path to the 100-inch telescope dome, which looks like a big white steel silo. Apparently, it was the biggest telescope ever built when it was installed 100 years ago, and some of the most revelatory insights about the universe were discovered here. Inside, walking up the narrow metal stairs, it's cool to see the century-old guts of a space-age relic. There are multiple levels, but I'm headed to the top, where a cluster of folding chairs are set out for a makeshift concert hall. Dan Cohn, who sits on the board of trustees for the Mount Wilson Institute, welcomes the few dozens of us gathered.
This place is, I'm going to use words like amazing and astounding over and over because that's kind of what it is. The universe was basically discovered here. In 1908, there were stars out there, there was a Milky Way, but it wasn't even known that it was a spiral galaxy. And then within 15, 20 years, other galaxies were discovered, or it was realized, and that the universe was expanding, which is the Big Bang. Most of cosmology comes from here. You're in for a treat. You're in for a big treat tonight. And it's going to start with this.
The roof of the dome opens, slowly yawning like a big mechanical mouth, revealing the afternoon sky. Then the sky starts to rotate. No, wait, we're rotating. And as we do, three musicians, harpist Marcia Dickstein, violinist Roger Wilkie, and cellist Cecilia Tsan, take the stage. A piece by French composer Jacques Ibert sounds much bigger than three instruments when it swells and bounces around inside the giant dome. It's the kickoff of the Sunday afternoon concerts in the dome at the Mount Wilson Observatory, now in its second year. I spoke to Cecilia Tsan, who's also the artistic director, at her home a few days earlier.
The director of development, Dan Cohn, asked me, since he knew I was a musician, he said, we want to somewhat revive that place, and would you like to come with your cello and test the acoustics? It sounded very interesting, and I had never been there. And so, yes, I went, and I said, yes, totally possible. The acoustic was absolutely glorious there. It's a fundraiser and also a way of making this place alive and attract people to visit it. And it's very unique, especially when they open the dome. First of all, you see the sky while you play. You feel like you're in sync with the universe. Bruce Babcock, who is writing the string quartet that we are going to play in July, his father and grandfather were some of the founders of the Mount Wilson Observatory. They were scientists also. We're playing the Verklärte Nacht, which means the transfigured night. So we try to have a connection with planets, the sky, astronomy, and the night.
After the concert, I spoke to a woman named Janet from Glendale, who was here at the Dome for the first time with her husband and daughter.
I thought it was a great tie-in to the history of the telescope. I love science. I love space science. And so for me, it was two of my favorite things that came together.
Did the love of science and the surroundings affect the way you experienced the music?
Yes, and I think there are song choices. There are pieces around the time that the telescope was, built. So it got me back to the feeling of what it must have been like when the telescope first came to LA and the excitement of it. And I thought the pieces really matched that. So I thought it was a good blend.
What do you feel like science and music, how do they relate to each other for you? Or what do they have to kind of say to each other for you?
Oh, this is really deep. But I think there are a lot of similarities. I think on a deep philosophical level, I guess we're both science and music is is searching for meaning in life, and both complement each other. That's how I feel about that.
From the Dome, for The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
The next concert in the series is this Sunday, June 3rd. You can find the entire schedule at the Mount Wilson Observatory website. And one note on our way out, there are new developments in the ongoing Harvey Weinstein story. Three women have filed a class action lawsuit against the producer, his former company, Miramax Films, and its former board of directors, among others. The suit alleges, in part, that the company failed to protect women from sexual assaults going back to 1996. Meanwhile, earlier this week, a grand jury formally indicted Weinstein on charges of rape and a criminal sex act involving two other women. And that's all we have for this week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, and Monica Bushman, with help this week from Jonathan Shiflett. Our interns are Maria Alexa Cavanaugh and Marcy Landgren, and our engineer is Valentino Rivera. I'm John Horn. Have a great weekend. Join us back here on Monday.